Today on this bonus episode, I'm catching up with Vince Scully and we're answering your questions in relation to investing and shares. Okay, so Emma asks, it may have already been covered as I'm new to this podcast, but dividend versus non-dividend paying shares would be interesting. So we did touch on that, but basically, if you're a company, Vince Scully Incorporated, and you had you were trying to find gold out the back of New South Wales, and you were digging, and you were making some profit, it wouldn't make sense to give your profit away. It would make more sense to invest that back into your business so you can hopefully find more gold. So is that a really bad example of...
No, that's a good example. But I think from an investor perspective, I think you got to start with, well, why am I investing in this share? Do I need income today? So if I'm a 65-year-old retiree and I'm living off my pension, dividends are good.
Is that like a year away for you?
No, it's a little bit more than one.
Zing. Zing.
You're listening to My Millennial Money, where the only daddy issues we talk about are sugar daddy issues. That's it.
But getting back to Emma's problem, so if you want income, dividends are good. And in Australia, dividends have the advantage that they generally come with a tax credit.
Yeah, and so we might swing back around to...
Yeah, we'll come back to that later.
Yeah.
But there's a few things you need to look at. If a company is not paying dividends because it's reinvesting and you think management is good, that's probably a good thing because you won't pay tax on the gain until you actually sell it. And if they're reinvesting, they're probably going to increase their future income. If, on the other hand, they're not paying dividends because they're not paying profits because their underlying business is terrible,
that's an issue.
Then that's something that you need to have a look at. So, yeah, companies like Amazon hardly ever pay dividends because they keep reinvesting it.
But they've got a really good track record at the moment for taking over the world.
So far, so good.
Yes.
So why do you want to buy them is important. What are you looking for? Are you looking for long-term growth above inflation, or are you looking for income? In many cases, most of the top 200 shares will give you a bit of both. I think the average yield on the top 200 shares is about 5%.
And if we just, for clarity, the yield is basically what the dividend is. It's the return.
As a percentage of your purchase price.
Yes. So talk to me. So you've covered, not paying a dividend. Why would a company want to pay a dividend? So like the big banks in Australia, they have good dividend growth. Why would a company pay dividends to reward their investors?
Your company will generally pay dividends for a few reasons. Firstly, if they've got nothing better to do with the money.
Sure.
So I think if I was a CBA investor, I would much rather they give the money back to me, because their track record of investing is not particularly good. But they've got a fundamentally good underlying business.
Yes.
So that's good in the hands of an investor. It's also because many of the big holders in bank shares are retirees.
Right.
I can't remember the percentage. Yes. But a very large proportion of retail investors, that is not investment companies, are older and are depending on their investment for income. So they find it attractive, and with the tax credit that comes with it, they find it even more attractive. And that tax credit comes, just to explain that, so let's say BHP makes $100 in profit. Well, let's make it $154 in profit.
Yes.
And it pays 30% tax. So it'll have $100 left, and it can pay a $100 dividend. Now, that $100 dividend comes with a credit for the $54 in tax that BHP has paid. So,
and that's called a franking credit?
That's called a franking credit.
Yes.
Franking, for your millennial listeners,
yes,
comes from the concept of a stamp, because when you used to pay tax, you used to stamp your
tax receipt or
your receipt. So, and a franking machine was the thing that marked the stamp. So that's why it's called a franking credit. So when you receive that, if you're a 30% taxpayer, you will, although you get $100 in cash, the tax office will say, actually, you got $154 with a $54 credit, which means that on the $154, you'll be need to pay tax of $54, and you get a credit of $54.
Right.
So no further tax is payable.
Is it a messy system?
No, it actually works quite well. I mean, there is a timing difference, but when you go to fill out your tax return, if you do it online using MyGov, it's usually pre-filled.
From your tax, everything being linked from your tax file number.
Yeah, because BHP report to the tax office saying, well, we paid
Glenn James
$100.
Yes.
And of that, $54 was a franking credit.
Yes.
So it will turn up when you go to do your tax return online. If you have a lot of shares, though, it can become a bit messy.
Yep.
And that's where an accountant or a financial advisor or a wrap account will come in handy.
So that's a really good thing just to work through. And you might notice that the speed and the style of this little interview might not be like our usual episodes, but we just want to be very considered and measured and walk through these things because, you know, if you don't know anything about shares or dividends or investing, it's all new to you. We're going to answer. So Vince and I just answered Emma's question, which is, it may already have been covered as I'm new to this podcast, but dividends versus non-dividend paying shares will be interesting. Part two of that question is about the dividend imputation and the taxation on dividends for retirees and the labor policy. Vince and I went down a 10-15 minute rabbit hole. So we're going to put that in at the very end of the episode if you want that. So Taylor asks, what are the pros or the cons of dividend reinvestment? Let's start and explain. We don't want to assume.
Yep.
What is dividend reinvestment?
A good question, Taylor.
Just hold that up.
The concept being that when you are entitled to a dividend, you would ordinarily get it in cash or by deposit to your bank account.
Or check.
Or check in, as it used to be. And a dividend reinvestment plan allows you to tick a box and say, don't give me the cash, give me more shares instead. And traditionally, that usually came with a discount. So usually it says, well, give me shares at...
Instead of being $5 a share, you might be able to reinvest at $4.80.
Yeah. And it also saves you paying brokerage. So you don't pay CompSec $19.95 for that purchase. So building up, for long-term investors, building up savings, it was very helpful. The downside is that you're still going to get taxed on the dividend, even though you haven't actually got it in cash. So you need to make sure that you've got cash set aside.
It's deemed income.
It is income.
Yep.
You've just received it as a...
Not money, but as in a share.
As a share. Yep. So you'll still have to pay tax on it. So you'll need to make sure you have the cash when it comes tax time. The other downside is...
And that, just to get really technical and we don't get that deep on this show, that dividend income wouldn't be treated as a capital sale. It would be treated as income straight onto your income section of your tax return.
Yep.
Yep.
So the other disadvantage of it is that you're buying something, or you're making a decision at one point in time to buy something at a time in the future. So when you tick that box, you're saying that I don't quite know what price BHP is going to trade at in 6 months' time when I get my dividend, or 6 years' time when I get my dividend, and I'm making a decision to buy it today. So you're buying something at a discount to the price, but you don't actually know what the price is going to be. And would you have made that decision at the time? Now, only history will tell you the right answer to that, but it's a different decision than choosing to buy BHP today.
So that could possibly be a con, as in not a pro, like a negative to dividend reinvestment.
That's right. And then the other con is it can create a lot of paperwork. So as Glenn just noticed, that this dividend is not counted as a sale, it's counted as income, but it does get added into your cost of the shares for when it comes to working out your capital gain at the end of the day. And if you're doing this every 6 months or for some shares every 3 months and you do this for 10 years or 20 years or a lifetime, that's a lot of paperwork.
And a nightmare.
And trying to unpick this can be a huge problem, and you may end up paying your accountant a lot of money if you if your paperwork's not straight. So they're the two main disadvantages.
Yeah.
The big advantage, of course, is that out of sight, out of mind, you get a discount, you don't pay brokerage, and because you're paying your tax out of other money, you're actually forcing yourself to save more.
It's forced savings.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're confident in the shares you're holding, so for example, if you were going to hold a broad share fund like a Vanguard ETF, reinvesting might make a lot of sense.
Sure. And for
but that is a quarterly one, so you will create a lot of paperwork.
Yeah. And I guess we covered with Emma's questions dividend versus non-paying dividend shares, and I guess to bookend, someone might take a dividend if they have retired from the workforce and they've got a substantial amount of shares, and every 6 months, 3 months, they take that income and live off it.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, if you're in accumulation stage, you're still working, so you don't really need the income from the shares. So, yes, you might just throw it back in the market. Or, as a crazy strategy, you might have your cash account on CommSec or E-Trade, and your strategy might be all my shares, I pay the dividend into the cash account and I buy other companies with that.
Yeah, so that means you're making the decision at the time
where you're going to invest.
You know at the time.
Yes.
And you don't end up with a huge investment in
an overweight position in that stock.
And most stockbrokers are overweight.
However, the con of that, if you had $3,000 worth of dividends and you had to reinvest, you're paying brokerage, as you said.
Correct.
So I guess it's everything is choose your own adventure. Fiona, she asks, one, are shares even worth it? Should I bother trying to invest? Where do I begin and who do I invest in? Lol. Two, is cryptocurrency dead and gone, or is now a good time to invest before it picks up again? So I guess...
quite a wide-ranging question.
It is. I guess we covered where do I begin and, you know, what do I invest in probably in the last episode, and we mentioned some ETFs if you were interested. Are shares even worth it? Well, I think it's a philosophical argument of I've got X amount of income in my life. I spend X amount and I'm left with Y. What do I do with the Y amount? Now, if I've got $1,000 left per month, I might decide, hey, Vince, I'm going to invest $500 in an account there because I want to save up to do a home renovation or a kitchen or whatever, a holiday. Or, and the other $500, I want to invest into the future. And it could be, what do I want to invest in? Do I want to buy an investment property and use that spare $500 a month to help with the upkeep of that? Do I want to contribute to super to make the... and a bit more tax effective and put it away for the long term? Or do I have a 10-year short term or 5-year short term goal that I do want to invest and I don't want that money parked in cash? Shares may be an option because they're liquid. In the episode with Asher, we discussed what a liquid asset and investment asset was. I think that was 204.
And it's not a barrel of beer.
So I guess, are shares even worth it? Well, the overarching statement is history says absolutely.
That's right. I mean, but there's sort of five things you can invest in.
Yeah.
Which is shares, real estate, bonds or IOUs, commodities or cash. And only two of those are capable of beating inflation long term, and that's shares and real estate. So the real question...
And I'll just jump in on that for a sec. When you say beat inflation, in other episodes we've talked about, you know, CPI and inflation, and actually the same episode with Asher, we did a bit of a glossary of terms. So for example, if I'll give you an example. If inflation is 2% per year and I've got cash in the bank earning 1.5%, the value of my cash is, strictly speaking, decreasing by 0.5% every year. Whereas if I invest in a good growth company that is growing, you know, long-term average of 7%, last time I checked, 7% was higher than 2%.
Really?
I think so. I never claimed I was intelligent.
Well, you must have paid attention in maths class.
Yes. So, anyway, you were basically ranting about the five types.
Yeah. So, if you're setting money aside to achieve a goal, and that goal is more than a year or two away, you have the ability to make your pile bigger by investing. So effectively, the more return you can make on your money that you set aside, the less of today's money you have to set aside to achieve tomorrow's goal. So investing is therefore, for any long-term goal, is critical. And I would say to most people, you know, that the trick to achieving those goals is to start investing, stay invested, and then invest some more. And that leaves you with the question, well, what do I invest in?
Mm.
And for long-term goals, yeah, 7 years or more, it really comes down to shares or real estate, or in most cases, a bit of both. And history will tell you that in Australia, over 20 or long-term periods, 10, 20, 30 years, they sort of have the same return.
Mm.
And
yeah, I'm not an advisor that gets caught up in shares only or property only. I just do both.
Yeah. It's not an either or.
No,
it's how much of each is the question.
Yes.
And
so I guess to Fiona's point...
Yes is the answer.
The shares are worth it. Should I bother trying to invest? Well, I would bother getting your finances sorted so you know every single month how much you've got left over.
Correct.
After your living expenses, after your, I don't know, annual girls weekend to Melbourne or whatever you do. You might be from Melbourne, but you know what I mean? Like just
well, then how much... be a weekend in Dalesford, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So I guess I would say, should you bother trying to invest? Absolutely. Once you know how much you've got left over at the end of every month, and once you've got a clear outline of what your financial goals are, and if you're in a partner relationship, what our collective goals are. So it's funny, in financial planning and the stuff that we do every day, the shares, the investment, the do I do it super, non-super, all that stuff takes care of itself. The time is working. What are your goals, some variables, and how do we get there?
That's right. And yeah, this whole... the why am I doing this? The answer to that question will, in most cases, tell you what the answer is. And the rest is technical implementation.
That's right. And I would, and the reason we harp on this so much, if you don't have clear goals, you'll invest your 10 grand or whatever in the share portfolio. 7 months later, oh, something came up. I've got to do this and I don't have the money for it. And you end up selling down. And one, it could have been at a reduced market rate. Mm-hmm. Two, it might not be. But there's no point investing in shares if you have any type of... If you're going to sell it within 4 years, I think.
Yeah. So if it's money that you plan on spending in the next year or two, cash is probably the only place for it.
Yeah.
It may not be glamorous. It may not be sexy. It may not have huge return. But it means that it's there and it's accessible. And if your goal is something that you're going to spend over the next year or two, that's the place for it. When we start to get to longer-term goals like saving a deposit for a home, retirement, those longer-term, so 7 years plus, you really need to be in these so-called growth assets, which is shares or real estate.
Yeah.
In the middle between those two periods, it's a bit of a, well, it depends. And the it depends can largely be answered by how time critical is this goal. So if you can defer the goal because the market's not done what you thought it was going to do, then take advantage of the growth. If you're, say, saving to buy an investment property, you could defer that by a year if the market was down. If your goal is saving to send your kids to high school, they're not going to change the year they go into year seven just because the market's down.
Exactly.
So that's why goals are so important.
I guess I don't want to camp on the crypto thing, but I would say to me that sits in speculative at this climate. Mm-hmm. And I always tell my clients, don't invest in any speculative stuff of more than 10% of your net worth outside of your home value.
Yep.
Just as a...
I'm treated like buying a lotto ticket.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people do win the lotto.
They do.
Some people make lots of money in crypto.
Some don't.
But some don't.
Yeah. I met a guy in the States. I think he got about over $3 million from crypto at the end of 2017. It wasn't me. Georgie asks, my boyfriend and I are in our mid-20s and are ready to buy a home, but we are also interested in shares. Should we be concentrating on saving a larger deposit than paying off as much as possible of the mortgage, or putting money into shares / EFTs?
Mid-20s.
Yeah. While you think about that, I would probably say one thing. Depending on what your income is, and chat with your mortgage broker, if you can get into a house within the next however long without paying lender's mortgage insurance, knock yourself out, buy a house, live in it, and enjoy life. Okay, that's number one. If you have to pay a little bit of LMI to get into that house and it is a long-term home that you're going to live in together, because I'm assuming it is are ready to buy a home rather than a property. So when people say home, I usually think to live in. It's like my place, Vince. Not a house, it's a home.
That's right. You can tell because the fruit bowl's empty.
Yeah.
It's like Julie Killard's kitchen.
Yes, exactly. So what I would probably say is, from a personal finance point of view, just focus on one thing at a time, and that's a big goal. Get in the home, get settled. You might decide when you buy the house that, oh, crap, we want a pergola out the back that costs $2,000, you know, do that, and then maybe swing back around a year later or 6 months, depending on once your budget has resettled, once you've in your new home, adjusted to rates and mortgage repayments and all that, then swing back to what we started with, like how much have you got left over per month and what do we do with it? It might be then investing, and then, you know, it could be we're going to pay down a little bit more on the mortgage, or we're going to pay into an EFT, or we're just going to do shares on the side or cap out super first. I don't know.
Yeah. The one point I would make is...
And Vince is probably going to have a better answer than me, so...
No, I think I agree with a fair bit of that, Clint. But the point I was about to make was that it's a bit misleading to think of your home as an investment. And I know that's controversial, but your home is really a hedge against future rent increases. And because there's a whole bunch of expenses involved in getting in, you need to be there for a long period to come out ahead. And those costs are about, you know, stamp duty, legal fees, agents' fees, lawyers' fees, inspections, a whole bunch of costs. So, but over a long enough period, you will almost always spend less if you buy rather than rent. Now, the big unknown is how long that period is. And if you think you're going to have to move in the next 5 years, either because you want to move cities or you're single now and you want to move in with a partner at some point, or you're buying a one-bedroom unit and you think you might have some kids, then you need to take that period into account. And the big thing is to make sure that the home that you buy
is not too much home.
Mm.
So I always advise people to buy real estate, not too much, when the time is right for you.
Yes.
And as you're becoming a more settled couple from your question,
yeah,
now might very well be the right time.
So I guess to really break this down, should we be concentrating on saving a larger deposit and paying off as much of our mortgage as possible or putting money into shares, EFTs? I would probably say rule number one, we're not putting any money into shares, EFTs until you've got into the home and have settled the budget, which...
Yeah, I mean, knowing what this monthly surplus is critical to all of these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the biggest destroyer of wealth that I see is people buying too much home.
Yeah.
So how much of your income you spend on your home affects critically what's left to spend on other things.
Yes.
And those other things are, you know, obviously living, so buying your morning coffee, having a holiday, sending your kids to after-school activities, and saving for goals, whatever those goals might be.
And the first part, you know, you want as large a deposit as possible. I mean, if you find the perfect home and the mortgage broker says, yeah, you're good to go, but it's going to cost $3,000 of lender's mortgage insurance, you might just, yeah, we'll take that, as opposed to going, oh, we're just going to wait and save another $10,000 so I don't have to pay the $3,000 mortgage insurance, and then we might not find the home. I would be in favor of just getting the right home at the right time for you.
So that's right.
Because these things are kind of broke. The question is kind of put all in one. I just want to really split it out and go, don't worry about any type of investing until you've settled the budget and you've got your home, and then get into a home as soon as you're ready.
Yes. Now, just unpicking that slightly.
Yes.
For many people, the stability needed to buy a home, in terms of, am I going to be living in this location with this requirement for accommodation for the next 5 or more years, may not be clear until... some years have passed, in which case you should be investing your surplus in the meantime. But once you've made the decision that now is the right time to buy a home, maximizing your deposit is generally a good thing because of this thing called lender's mortgage insurance. I wouldn't sort of demonize it too much, that in many ways paying a bit of lender's mortgage insurance is not the end of the world, because as Glenn knows, it could actually take you longer to save the extra money.
And there could be some opportunity cost and property, lifestyle
and property
cost.
Property prices
and
could go up in the meantime. Yeah. So in a rising market, a bit of LMI is not the end of the world.
I paid $15,000 of LMI when I got my place, and within 3 years it was worth $300,000 more.
Yeah.
So would I have rather waited? I don't even need to answer that. Yeah. But I just want to...
Finishing off on that. But if you're paying mortgage insurance because you've got a few thousand dollars sitting in shares or ETFs, the cost of the LMI might very well outweigh the return you're going to make on those shares.
Absolutely.
So it will depend on the circumstances at the time, but in general, buy the right amount of house and make sure it fits your budget. In many ways, you know,
and don't have more than 30% of the household net take home in rent or mortgage repayments. 25% is ideal. Yep. 20 is freaking amazing. Yep. 0% is amazing because it means you own the place.
Or you live with mum and dad.
You live with mum and dad. And just following on for that, and all these things, like, don't take this as gospel financial advice because we don't actually know all the details. It's just a really good discussion. So, Jane asks, maximizing my savings and investing in the right EFTs, so when it comes to liquidating them for a home deposit, I've know I've done my best. So I guess conversely, it's the opposite end of Georgie. Jane might be on the starting blocks of saving for a house. Absolutely, you know, we talked about the Vanguard funds in the ETF episode and the share episode. For example, they're liquid. You can get the money out within 3 days. So what I would probably do as a strategy if you did go down the road of, hey, I probably, it's realistically going to take 4 years to save my home deposit. And just a side note, Vince, there's not many couples, particularly in the areas, you know, a couple of hours of Sydney, that are, and probably Melbourne and Brisbane to a point, that are buying their first home under 30 years old. So
yeah, I think the average age is now 31.
Yeah. So I would recommend, one, just chill out if you're under 30 and you don't own a home, because it's pretty normal. And two, if it is a four-year journey away and you did invest into EFTs, what you might do is, if you're, it looks like you're a year away from, you know, withdraw. So I'll work this way. You're saving towards a $50,000 deposit wherever you are. Okay, you want to buy a little townhouse. It's whatever. If, for example,
in parts of Sydney, that's called a stamp duty bill.
Exactly. So I'm talking about regional areas as an example, because we've got listeners all over Australia. So, if your goal is $50,000, and you've got a 4 year plan to get there, at the end of year three, if you think, or if the market is not great, for the last year, you might just save cash and not invest.
Yeah.
And then, so in the end of the year four, you might have $40,000 in shares and 10 in cash, and then it can be a sell down process. So I guess, what's her question here? Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a problem. Although I would probably look at capping out the first home super saver scheme.
Yeah, I mean, I think first, that should be your first port of call, yep, when you're saving money up to the limit, which I can't remember what it is off the top of my head.
It's,
we did an episode on this.
Yeah, we did. 30 grand over 3 years, capped at 15 grand a year.
Yeah. So I'd start by capping that out. So if you're setting money aside...
That could be wrong as well, but we're just...
But if you're setting money aside to buy a home, and you're otherwise not maxing your super app, then that's the first port of call.
Yeah.
As long as you're confident that that's what it's going to be used for.
Yes.
And of course, super is just a structure. So the question is, well, I'm putting into my super, but what I'm actually going to invest it in.
Mm.
And your points about shares and ETFs are just as applicable inside super.
Yes.
But the key point is, yeah, am I setting aside enough to achieve my goal within my time frame?
Yep.
And part of that is, what do I think I can earn in this money in the meantime?
Yep. And I guess in closing, because you're probably late to your little...
Yeah. It is just around the corner.
Yeah. My recommendation, for want of a better word, or suggestion is probably a nicer word, would... Because I can only say kind of what I do, and I don't do single stocks. So I don't have a CompSec or E-Trade account that I buy BHP and Telstra and trading and all that. Because one, I'll tell you, number one, if you Google, trading is hazardous to your wealth, the common stock investment performance of individual investors. It was a guy from the University of Berkeley, and there's a report that they did where basically people who just buy an index fund and leave it and add to it outdo people who constantly buy and sell shares.
Yeah, I think that's true, that most people don't have the psychological bent to do this consistently.
Yes.
That the problem with share investing for many people is that the higher the stock market goes, the more people want to invest. So the average investor ends up buying when it's high and selling when it's low, which is the exact opposite of what you should be doing. So the advantage of buying a basket of shares,
be it a managed fund, an index fund, or
listed investment company or whatever, as opposed to single ones, is it removes some of this temptation.
Yes. Now, I will say, back to the rule, I tell my clients, hey, if you want to have a little E-Trade account or whatever just for fun or your own little thing, again, not more than 10% of your net worth outside of your home, because there's less risk. We're just,
yep,
with all this speculative fun stuff or crypto or whatever, if you keep it to a rule, 10% of your net worth.
You can't go too far wrong.
It's not going to blow up your life.
That's right. So the advantage of a basket, as I said, is the temptation to move in and out is reduced. And if there's, you're looking
more
at
diversification,
basket, more diversification, and
the administrative.
Administrative costs are lower.
And a year.
And the advantage, if you're going to pick a basket, picking an index basket, that is a basket where you're not paying a fund manager to trade, probably reduces your costs and will, in many cases, yield a more stable return.
Yep. All right, Vince, thank you so much for joining us on this extended little bonus deep dive into shares.
Thanks, Dean. Good to be here.
That was great. Oh, just Vince has got a cool website, lifesherpa.com.au.
Come and check us out.
Yeah. And thank you.
Cheers, Glenn.
Bye.
Remember, we hang out on Insta at My Millennial Money. If you're a regular listener, you're welcome to join our Facebook group. If you want more money hacks, be sure to subscribe to My Millennial Money Express. It's short money hacks anywhere, anytime, right into your ears. Any advice in this podcast is of a general nature only and has not been tailored to your personal circumstances. Please seek personal advice prior to acting on this information. Before making a decision to acquire a financial product, you should obtain and read the product disclosure statement relating to that product. Opinions constitute our judgment at the time of issue and are subject to change. Neither the licensee, any of the National Australia Group of Companies, nor their employees or directors give any warranty of accuracy, nor accept any responsibility for errors or omissions in this podcast. Glenn James, Urban Getter Proprietary Limited, trading as Sort Your Money Out, are authorised representatives of Apogee Financial Planning Limited, AFSL 230689.
Now, while we're in this rabbit hole of franking credits and dividends, why is it advantageous to retirees?
Well, it comes back to the fact that this tax has been paid at 30%. And most retirees either pay, well, to the most part, they pay low tax. So a super fund, that is a pension, is tax-free.
Yes.
So in the, for the most part, retirees are not paying tax at 30% or more.
It might even be 0%.
In many cases, it's zero. And so they actually get cash back for this franking credit.
From the ATO.
From the ATO. So going back to my $100 BHP example, a retiree receiving the $100 dividend, deemed income 154, tax credit 54, cash 100. They do their tax return and...
Because their tax rate's zero.
Because their tax rate's zero, they will now get $54 back from
the government.
Which is a bit of a quirk, really. And the Labor Party's got a proposal to abolish this at the moment, which would put us back to the pre-2000 position. So another history lesson from the old bloke in the corner here.
He's literally sitting in a corner.
So we go back to the 80s when Paul Keating was treasurer and Bob Hawke was...
He's the Prime old Minister. Guy that you see once a year at the cricket sculling a beer still.
That's right. And I must admit, at his age, he does it better than I've ever been able to do it. Mm. So Paul Keating's proposal when he brought in this whole franking system or imputation system was to say, well, companies pay tax at 30%. Why should we tax it again when they pay as a dividend?
Because it's really stopping double taxation.
Yeah. The goal was to stop double tax. So previously...
So Paul Keating being a Labor government, his party at the moment, the Labor government, are saying, no, we want to go back and double tax people and...
Well, no. They're going back to the pre-2000 position. So if we follow this story. So Keating said, BHP's already paid tax on this. So when you receive it, you shouldn't pay tax again. So we'll give you a credit for the tax that's already been paid. And then, so between 1987 and 2001, our case...
Which is basically when all the millennials were born.
our retiree receiving that $100 dividend would not have any tax, but they wouldn't get a rebate.
Sure.
And that's saying that actually companies pay tax at 30%.
Yep.
And the fact that you pay tax at least, we want to stop you being double taxed, but we're not trying to turn the company tax into just a withholding tax.
Sure.
So it's saying that companies pay tax at 30%, and a recipient of that dividend shouldn't have to pay the 30% again.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't intended to say, well, look, if you're not a taxpayer, you shouldn't get anything. Now,
yeah,
Now, 2001, I think, one of the Costello budgets, they were trying to fix up a whole bunch of technical issues around dividend imputation or franking, which is probably way too complicated to go into. But a consequence of that was they brought in this fact that now if you didn't owe the tax, you got a cashback. And what that means, that effectively turns company tax into a withholding tax, so that you pay tax at the lowest level along the chain, rather than simply saying companies should pay tax at 30%. And now, as the number of retirees has got so big, this is now a very large number.
Mm,
In fact, it's, as Bill Shorten will say, it's more than we spend on public schools, which is a bit of a fair fee, but it's a big number nonetheless. And they're now sort of looking at this. And it's a unique worldwide position. No other economy does this. And it seems is technically a bad answer. So the Shorten-Bowen proposal is to abolish the rebate. So everyone still gets the benefit. You just don't get cash if you don't want to use it.
Okay, so that if I earned $5,000 a year, which of my effective tax rate zero, mm-hmm. and spent $1,000, there's no offset anyway.
Correct. You reduce your taxable income by the $1,000 you spent.
But it doesn't matter because my tax rate is zero.
But it doesn't affect your tax because you're still zero.
So basically in retirement land, if my tax rate's zero and I receive a dividend that's already had 30% tax paid, my tax rate zero, who cares anyway? You're still getting the money, the dividend.
Correct.
So I guess what I'm saying is you won't be double taxed.
Correct.
However, you will not get a tax refund just because.
Correct.
Because your tax rate's zero.
So compared to today, every retiree in receipt of a franked dividend will be worse off than they are today. But they will be no worse off than they were between 87 and 2000. And I didn't hear anyone complaining, oh, look, I've got this extra income in 2000 after 2000 budget.
See, it's funny, this whole thing, because
so nobody complains when you reduce the tax, and everyone complains when you increase the tax.
But in this dividend imputation tax withholding thing, there's no double taxing.
Correct.
We're just closing a hole that would just give you a cash bonus.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, I guess what I want to say is my only concern is in financial planning land, we put strategies in place based on the law of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, a retiree may set up an investment company and buy shares in the company.
Sure.
And effectively pay a fully franked dividend to themselves. And then when they stop working, they can get a tax rebate from their own company the same way.
Yep.
Well, not a tax rebate, a literally cash.
Sure.
Back from the government. So that's in jeopardy.
It is, but these things happen all the time. In many cases, you may have heard the term grandfathering,
yeah,
where when things change adversely, they say, well, look, if you've already done this, we'll...
So, okay.
Like for capital gains tax was a good example.
Yes.
1986, 7?
I was...
87, I think.
I was 3 years old.
When capital gains tax was brought in, they said, well, look, if you've already owned an asset before August something in that year, this whole new regime won't apply to it. And that was a sort of a simple thing to administer.
So do you think if the Labor Party get into government and they do the stitching up of the tax credit turning into a cash payment, they would say from this date, any new dividends, or do you think they'll just not grandfather that?
Well, they're not proposing to.
Yeah.
It would be administratively very difficult, and it would stop people trading.
Mm.
So if, you know, if you're holding some BHP shares and you think, well, actually, Rio looks like a better bet today, you now have a huge tax incentive to stay with BHP, which is probably, A, difficult to administer, and B, it creates economic distortions, which I guess the CGT change did too, but it was probably administratively simpler because there were fewer transactions. But, you know, no one was clamouring for it to be grandfathered when Costello was offering to give you cash back.
That's right.
So, yeah, it's one of these things where no one ever whinges when tax goes down, but everyone whinges when tax goes up.
Mm.
And this is the whole dilemma in designing a tax system, because most government spending goes to people who don't pay tax.
Mm.
And most, so the people who pay the tax get less of the benefits. So it's a very difficult problem to solve.
Mm.
And you can't please all of the people all of the time. And there are already huge subsidies to so-called self-funded retirees, of which I hope to be one not too far away. But, yeah, this is a transfer of wealth from working families to retirees. And whilst, you know, some people clearly need to be looked after in their period post-employment, I think the pendulum has swung a little bit too far.
Mm.
And Costello has been a big contributor to that. That the good times in the
But the same the can 2000s. Be said with the Costello, or the Howard/Costello government, with the middle class welfare that they dished out to buy votes, effectively.
Well, this is a form of middle class welfare.
Yeah.
Because the benefit goes to retirees with substantial assets outside
their family home.
Because if they don't have substantial assets, they'll be getting an age pension. Mm. So it's a system that needs rework, but it's very difficult to do.
And well, I think the Labor Party can get it across, because Chris Bowen came out and was on the front page of the newspaper a couple of weeks ago. Hey, retirees, don't vote for us then. So that's...
Yeah. So it's a technical tax change, which from a policy perspective is a good thing. But clearly on every tax policy, there's a human being at the other end of it. And this will create significant stories. So politically, it's a really difficult thing to do.
Mm.
So in some ways, you have to admire their courage.
Mm.
I guess courageous decision, Minister.
Well, I guess I'm all for it if they bloody put that money to something decent like infrastructure.
Sure.
So that's not a problem. That was a big rabbit hole, wasn't it?
It was. And I suspect it's a sort of an unpopular view.
Mm.
So I guess,
yeah, I don't... I'm just thinking, like, would I vote if there was a vote, should this happen, yes or no? What would I say? Don't know.
Yeah, this is, you know, are you going to favour your today self or your tomorrow self?
Mm.
But, you know, on the subject of Paul Keating, I mean, he's famous for saying that in any race you should always back self-interest, because self-interest is the only one you know that's trying. And in this case, there is a very large self-interested constituency, which is concentrated largely in relatively safe coalition seats.
Mm.
So maybe it's not going to affect the Labor vote that much.
But it's so funny. Like, at the end of the day, if you're a self-funded retiree, okay, number one, if they did turn off the cashback, for want of a better term, mm-hmm. You would have to eat into your capital, potentially.
assume you were spending everything.
Yeah, if you were spending everything. Yeah. However, there is that safety net. If your assets decrease, you might be able to get onto the age pension anyway. So I think it's
so,
more of
so
a...
no one is going to have to worry about putting bread on the table.
Exactly. So I think while it is a bit of a slap to one's face, I don't know if there will be a net-net difference if you deplete your assets and have to jump on, you know, get a portion of age care, a portion of the age pension.
And ultimately, in most cases, this will actually flow through to smaller estates.
Mm. Anyway, that's a big rabbit hole. What I might do is I might put that rabbit hole in after the episode as a bonus. So
a bonus side.
Yeah. So I'll just say something. So basically, you're listening to My Millennial Money, and we've got a little bonus episode today following the episode we did earlier with Vince Scully and John about investing in shares. We ran out of time and we still had a heap of questions that needed to be answered. So I've actually ditched John. I'm in the city with Vince. How are you, Vince? You good?
G'day, Glenn. So is this a bonus-ode?
This is a bonus-ode. Is that the term, is it?
I think that's the technical term.
Yeah. So I've grabbed the portable gear. We're in Sydney and we've got a coffee each. And that was a cool couple of episodes we did. Thanks for coming up
fun.
To the studio.
It was fun. And the coffee was good up there too.
Yes, it is.
Better than this coffee.
Really? Yeah, I actually don't like this one, but we won't name names. Okay.
In fact, I drove past the Glee coffee roastery on my way home.
Oh, did you go up to the hospital?
I did.
You? Yeah.
Beautiful building.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it?
No, I meant the coffee roastery, not the hospital.
Oh. Vince wasn't going to the hospital to check in. He was doing a drive-by past Glee to visit Wyong Hospital because there's a bit of history there that he wanted to get a photo for somebody. So you're a nice guy, Vince.
I do my bit.
Mm.